Hello, and welcome to today's Energy Star Lamps V2.0 Draft 1 webinar. I'm Austin Gelder with ICF International, and we are here on behalf of EPA's Energy Star program. I want to walk through just a couple of logistics that we may have walked through about a minute ago. So first, today's webinar is going to be recorded, so we're going to try and make that available at a later time. Second, all lines are currently on mute, but we can unmute lines by pressing a star 6 for Q&A. If you have any questions during the webinar, please feel free to enter them into the chat section located within your control panel. And if you're having other logistical issues, and you can either let us know through the chat section, or you can email lighting@energystar.gov. I'm pleased to announce that Taylor Jantzell from the US EPA, me, Austin Gelder from ICF International, and Emily Van Gruber from DNR International will be leading today's webinar. So for today's agenda, we'll have our introductions. We'll briefly discuss the specification development process. We'll talk about the goals of this particular specification revision. And then we're going to go into some of the changes compared to LAMPS Draft 1, or sorry, LAMPS Version 1, to LAMPS Version 2 Draft 1. We're going to talk about scope, definitions, photometric performance, lumen maintenance, electrical performance, controls, labeling and packaging, and then we're going to wrap up and talk about the timeline that we are anticipating for this specification. So at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Taylor Jantzell, who is in person, and we'll go through some of the in-person introductions.
Thank you, Austin. I'll begin. This is Taylor Jantzell with US EPA. And in the room, we have a number of folks. We're going to go around. I'll start to the left.
Hi, it's Emily Van Gruber from DNR International.
This is Nicholas Case from DNR International.
Anthony Sears, representing Lucidity Lights.
Sam Levinson, ICF International.
Alex Baker, Phillips Lumi Leds.
Alex Bosenberg, NEMA.
Dave Gatto, Westinghouse Lighting.
Tom Sinek, GE Lighting.
Joe Howley, GE Lighting.
Steve Cook, Phillips Lighting.
Great, and we want to know, want to let everyone know that while you're on the phone or in the room, you all have a seat at the table, so please feel free to speak up, whether it's through the webinar or through unmuting your line. We will be pausing throughout the webinar to make sure you have ample time to ask clarifying questions or any questions for that matter. This is the opportunity for us to explain the driving force for the specification revision, and we're going to just basically just be covering the changes that have been proposed in Draft 1 for LAMPS version 2.0. Again, for everyone's benefit, when you do speak up, please state your name and your organization. So the goals of the specification are also the reasons for revising. First and foremost, to align with DOE's pending test method for LED lamps. Many of you may be aware that DOE is in a rulemaking process to support the FTC lighting facts labeling for LED lamps. In order to facilitate a smooth transition and not provide conflicting testing methodologies between Energy Star and what manufacturers have to do to support the FTC label and following DOE's test method, we have opened up the specification to make sure that we accommodate that test method when it is final. Another reason we are looking to revise at this time is that since we revised the LAMP spec last, we've seen tremendous increases in efficacy, and so we are looking to increase efficacy levels in the specification revision. We are also looking to broaden the scope and features for LAMPS to be included under the specification based on market developments. And consistent with our other lighting specifications, we are trying to harmonize program requirements between lighting specifications, and we have the ability to do that as we're running a concurrent revision process between lamps and luminaires right now. I want to reiterate that this isn't meant to be a major overhaul. We are trying to minimize retesting and any kind of major changes. We're just trying to move the bar a little bit and accommodate DOE's test method when it is final. So for the most part, until DOE's test method is final, there shouldn't be any testing needed for these products to meet and be recertified to these new levels. And again, it's to really capture the tremendous improvement in efficacy for LED lamps and the drop in cost as well that has happened over the course of those last few years.
From the Peanut Gallery, Alex Bosenberg, NEMA. Taylor, you said that aligned with DOE's LED lamps test procedure. Since the original NOPR is like a year and a half old and the supplemental NOPR is about 8 months old, do you know something we don't? It seems to be deadlocked, and not that I don't want to upgrade to that test procedure.
Well, certainly you'll have to speak to DOE about their timeline, but it is an open process, and we want to make sure if we're opening that we are making room for that.
Okay.
So the specification development process, as many of you are familiar, involves multiple drafts. The first few drafts are followed by a four-week comment period, depending on how those go and the substance of the comments between those periods. We will get closer to a final specification where the comment period goes down to about 2 weeks. So what we're looking to do, because this is not a major overhaul, is release a few drafts of these four-week comment periods. We are looking forward to a robust stakeholder discussion in April 20th at 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. in Washington, D.C. We hope many of you can join us there in person, as it is in conjunction with an ACEEE CEE market transformation meeting. And hopefully we've given you enough notice to plan accordingly. We will also be having an afternoon meeting to discuss the luminaire specification development on that same day. We do really find that we have robust discussions when we have more stakeholders in person for these meetings, so we do encourage, if you are able to attend in person, to do so. So draft one was released in the middle of February. A reminder that the comment period for this draft ends on March 13th, and we look forward to receiving everyone's comments by that deadline. If you do need any additional time, please let us know as soon as possible. We can see if we can accommodate. We do hope to wrap this up in this spring, this second quarter, and then the effective date typically would be 9 months after it is finalized. So that would be sometime in Q1 or Q2 of 2016, depending on when it's on.
Is this the point where we want to discuss timing?
Probably, we're going to recap the timeline, and you can weigh in on whether you think the typical 9 months is appropriate or if more time would be necessary. Okay, just give us one moment. I think we have an old version of the presentation loaded.
Our concern is this is coming too soon on the heels of the previous version. And we had to go through and retool some of our lamps in order to meet that one. And so now with this one coming out, as soon as it is, we're not going to be able to recoup our investment. And so we believe that, you know, the typical 3 years between versions is more doable than what we've seen
you would have minimum 2 years between, you know, when that was finalized and when this goes effective. There's, you know, we're talking about 2016. This was finalized in 2013. I think sharing information about your recoup of investment, but also retooling, we anticipate the LED market moves so fast that, you know, this would not impact already certified products. It would be impacting new products that are brought in, that this is not meant to trigger redesign new
products. The concern really isn't with the LED products as much as it is with the CFL products. It's more mature and it's not changing as quickly as the LED products. So we're totally recouping the investments.
On the CFL.
Anthony Sears, Lucidity, it will impact already qualified products in the sense that it will force some of them off the list because of the increased efficacy levels in R9 requirements. So.
Correct, yes. But it won't. The intention was that products wouldn't necessarily need to be, they'd either fall off, new products would replace them, but not necessarily that they would be redesigned. My understanding is that there is not a lot of investment going into CFL technology, and we are trying to recognize the more efficient technology.
Taylor, I think that the concern is that such...
Joe Howley from...
Oh, yeah.
Joe Howley. Gee, there's such an enormous number of CFLs that are falling off the list that for the CFL product lines to maintain viability, that manufacturers will probably either be forced to redesign them to keep at least a meaningful number on them, or, well, I don't know, each manufacturer will make up its own mind what they're going to do, but there's not a lot of products left on the list that would qualify. And a lot of them that are left tend to be less, the lower volume specialty types, not the mainstream type of CFLs that are left, the more unusual colors and things like that.
The ones that can hit the proposed efficacy levels right now.
Yeah, and R9 and efficacy and all of the other things, you're left with an odd collection, a very small and odd collection of CFLs.
Keep it with Phillips. Yeah, our concern is the fact that what's going to happen is now it's going to be almost impossible for CFLs to meet the new specification. And so what's going to happen is you're going to see the whole market changing over to cheap brands, which will actually hurt the CFL market image. They'll just be going, there's no reason to, they can't hit, they'll just start bombing.
Well, with that being said, I mean, we're talking about timeline. We can talk about, you know, maybe what you perceive as a more reasonable timeline, but we can also, you know, as we consider all of the proposals in this, know that this is a first draft and that, you know, all of these proposals are, you know, subject to change based on your feedback. So this is a starting point. So, are we ready to go? Okay.
Yeah. There was a question from Gillian Saban. Products would need to be certified, and that has a cost.
That's true. There is a cost for recertification. We expect it to be very minimal for this type of revision. And then we're also talking about a 2-year difference between when this last revision was effective and this would be, you know, go into effect in 2016. So we also just, I think it's for perspective, our revision process has been slow over the past. And now that the technology is moving quicker, we are going to have to be moving quicker. Our consumer electronics specifications are on a constant revision cycle. And because they're using very similar technology. So it's a little bit different, but you'll see as we go through the presentation, you know, kind of a little bit more what's leading us down this road.
Keith Cook with Phillips. You're partial. We fully agree that is true of the LED lamps, but for conventional technology such as CFL, that is not true. And so you can't quite do that if you're trying to harmonize the specifications. You've got a technology that's not changing.
We're harmonizing the ENERGY STAR specifications, luminaires, and we're maintaining technology neutrality when it comes to our approach. However, we are continuously looking at recognizing the more efficient products in the market. Okay, so starting at the beginning, the changes that we made were to Section 1 and Section 4, and those address scope and definitions. And we added self-ballasted induction-driven electrolytes, fluorescent lamps, because they are now part of a revised LM65 and LM66 test method that we referenced, that we will update to maintain our technology-neutral approach. Those would now essentially be included in the specification because they have a test method for them now. We also included connected lamps and color tunable lamps.
By the way, Keith Cook and Phillips, we do appreciate that expansion because we do see significant movement in the market towards it.
Okay, so to accompany the expanded scope, we added definitions for these. Those induction-driven electrolytic fluorescent lamps, we borrowed from LM65 and 66. Self-ballasted fluorescent lamps, they are essentially very similar to a compact fluorescent, but these use electromagnetic induction to generate a discharge current, forming a closed loop inside the tube structure, which excites internal gases and converts this into visible light through phosphor. For the purposes of this specification, these lamps include integral electronic ballast and are equipped with an anti-standard base, and also we will be referring to them as induction lamps. The definition for connected, I just want to point out a slight oversight in the definition section that we'll be correcting for the next draft. The eligible connected lamps would include all elements or instructions is the clarification that I needed to make for this round here. They don't necessarily have to include all hardware and software required to enable communication in response to consumer-authorized energy or performance-related commands. So what that means is we're talking about labeling the lamp, whether or not it's sold with a system. So we're really focused on the here, and that's what we're referring to as the connected product.
Okay, Dave Gatto, Westinghouse. Thank you. That clarification helps because as you see the market start to pick up, there'll be less kits and more individual products that will work with existing systems. So
yeah, and the idea is really that we're focused on the lamp, the standby power of the lamp,
mm-hmm.
What the lamp is doing, and we want to make sure that whatever is delivered, how the lamp is delivered, all the necessary instructions for how to operate it and connect it are included, but that it's it can be sold on its own. Okay, we added a definition for color tunable lamps. For the purposes of the specification, a color tunable lamp has functionality that allows the end user to alter the color appearance of the light generated by the lamp. This tuning must include white light that is capable of meeting the specification's correlated color temperature requirements and can alter the appearance along the black body curve, or may also extend to colors beyond the ANSI-defined color temperature ranges. We also just wanted to clarify for color tunable lamps, we're only looking at measuring them at full power, full brightness.
Steve Carter, Westinghouse Lighting. I just want to clarify that because it came up in the Luminaire meeting. At its highest power setting or at its highest brightness setting?
So we'll get into that when we talk about how we're looking for multiple measurement points. But I guess my clarification here is that we know there are lamps that have warm dimming. They change color as they dim. We're not measuring color changing at low light settings.
Are you going to, Joe Howley G, are you going to pick a color temperature for which you're going to measure this?
You are.
3,000 or
30? You are.
So we're going to select or choose one and say it meets at this color temperature. So it has to meet at least one of the color points.
Yes.
That we
perfect transition to the next slide. So Section 5.1 covers testing of color tunable lamps. We are looking for a multitude of measurements not a lot. They may not even, you may not even need to do this many measurements because they may be one and the same. So when testing pollution of the lamp, we're looking at photometric performance testing performed at either at the default setting from the factory and the least efficient setting within the ANSI white light ranges, and that is chosen, designated by the manufacturer. We're also looking for the manufacturer to provide detailed guidance and potentially the settings or the controls necessary to reach that setting. So we make sure for repeatability for the test labs to be able to achieve that setting. They're basically going to be running all the long-term testing at the least efficient setting within the white light, chosen, designated by the manufacturer.
So if it could range from 2,700 to 60, all six color points listed there, you have to test at all six and pick which one's the least efficient.
You do. You mean you send it to...
The manufacturer.
Manufacturers
has to
understand where the least, if there is a least efficient, has to designate the least efficient point within the white light.
There'll definitely be a least efficient point.
But you have all, I mean, the manufacturer of all people will know where that point is best. And what we're asking for is how you can help us and help the third parties that, you know, administer the program to be able to achieve those settings for feasibility.
Hi, Taylor. This is Mark from Cree. The question about some of the other aspects of that we measure, such as omnidirectionality, is that only at at your
full brightness?
Full brightness, or other at a dim state also.
So all of our testing, aside from the dimming test criteria, is performed at full power.
Okay, thank you.
Are you going to get into keep going, Phillips? Are you going to get into Section 5.2?
No. What would you?
Well, we found that very confusing.
We don't believe we changed 5.2. Just covering what we changed today, but we can talk about other sections that could use improvement.
But because of the color tunable lamps, when 5.2 gets confused.
Okay. You can certainly look at that.
Okay, we'll
include
that in our remarks.
Sure. Yes, perhaps there were some unintended consequences there, so we can certainly revisit that section as it applies to the solar system today. Section 6, it's really just to remind everyone that DOE is in the process of the rulemaking for the test procedure for LED lamps. And that once it is final, EPA will accept testing conducted according to the DOE test procedure for the purposes of Energy Star, and will need to, and once it's effective, you know, that is the representations must be made based on DOE's test method. To give you a sense of what the DOE test method covers, it's everything on the FTC lighting facts label, so that's light output, CCT, input power, efficacy as a product, CRI, lifetime, and standby power. CRI, while it's not on the lighting facts label, is included in the DOE test method. We also wanted to point out that while not every single lamp type that is covered in the Energy Star specification is covered by the FTC rulemaking or the DOE test procedures, we are seeking to align, for consistency purposes, all lamps under Energy Star be measured and reported in a consistent fashion.
Keith Cook of Phillips. Also, under the DOE proposed lifetime, we want to go to the L70B50 instead of just L70. That's fine, but we also would prefer that the Energy Star make some allowances for mortality failures in products. And maintain the possibility that if one lamp is to fail, that we can still proceed with the testing.
So reported values have to be done consistent with DOE. So that's
mean, that's not something we have flexibility on.
Okay. What about tolerances on light output?
Again, the DOE will define how light output must be recorded.
So you're going to see a difference then between LED testing and CFL testing.
Correct, because of the DOE test methods vary towards the product.
Okay.
But the reported values for FTC purposes and when there is a DOE test method must be done in accordance with DOE's reporting. So there's gonna we are seeking to align consistency, recognizing that there are inconsistencies. Okay. Section 7.1, product variations. We did not propose any new product family changes, but we do wanted to note that we have received requests for CRI to be a variant, and we just want to remind stakeholders who are interested in adding CRI as an allowable variation for sharing long-term maintenance data that we need data to support this technical rationale for including this as a product variation. And we have received a small amount of data to date, but we will need more data in order to consider adding this in the specification. Section 8, the updated methods of measurement and reference documents. We removed reference to ANSI NEMA C82.2 2002 because it's outdated. We updated some methods and added some new methods to support the DOE energy conservation test procedure for light-emitting diodes. We added ANSI C82-77-2014. And IES LM82-12, you'll see where we reference that later. And then we anticipate 2015 updates to LM65 and LM66, as I mentioned earlier, because they're adding electrodeless induction lamps. And we're anticipating an update to ANSI C78.377. If there's anything that we've missed here, please let us know if you think we should be looking at other methods of measure reference documents to include. Okay, moving on to section 9.1, photometric performance requirements. Just a little bit of a backtrack on showing where we've been with efficacy over the past course of revisions. The CFL specification 4.3, which those dates are based on 4.0 and nothing changed for efficacy to 4.3, those were established in 2008 and became effective in 2009. You see, they were established, except for the GU24 ones, which were added later, but you see there wasn't a significant change from that to Energy Star Lamp 1.1, which was finalized in 2013 and effective in September 14. The bulk of CFLs have not been impacted largely by efficacy changes in the course of the specification revision process. And then for LED lamps, I just wanted to show that we also made very little changes to efficacy from the original Energy Star integral LED lamp specification version 1.0 that was finalized in 2009 to the new lamp specification. There are slight increases across lamp types, but nothing significant, and certainly nothing significant to capture the advances that have been made in the last few years. So what you'll also notice as a trend through the revision process is we are looking to greatly simplify how we are addressing product efficacy. It's been broken out in lots of different ways by watches in the past, and we're really each revision time, finding that we are able to simplify those levels. And I'll get into that a little bit more next, but just here's your quick glance of what changed from LAMP 1.0 and 1.1 to this new proposal.
Taylor, this is Al Spafarikas at Cree. Have you considered the effects that this has at different CCTs and CRIs?
Absolutely. I'm going to get right into that, Al. Thank you.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Okay. Next slide. So we did look at efficacy. So when I say we've been able to greatly simplify our approach to efficacy, that's because we did an analysis of efficacy by lamp type and by all lamps to look at the relationship between efficacy and CCT, CRI, lamp size, lumen output, and wattage. And when we looked at those, nothing aside from CCT where there was a slight difference, nothing was compelling enough to say that we should be continuing to set levels, efficacy levels, based on these variety of different features. CCT had the strongest relationship. Unfortunately, CRI, we don't have enough products to really have any really good indication. But what we do know is that we've set the levels in a way that would allow for a large variety of CCT, CRI size, lamp size, light outputs, that all the levels we have set do not impact negatively any of those performance criteria.
Keith Cook, Phillips. As your chart plainly shows, essentially you're eliminating CFLs from the market.
So what we've done here is, with efficacy for omnidirectional lamps, we've set the level at a point that is showing and capturing the more efficient products in the market, which here you can see by the color coding is LED. You see, we've seen the strongest growth, the most efficacious products brought in most recently in the omnidirectional category.
Okay.
Yeah, Joe Howley with GE. Is your intent to wipe out the CFL market? Because clearly 90% of the products above that are LED. That there's only a few, and those CFLs that are left, they tend to be specialty type CFL, not the bread and butter CFL.
And there's some CFLs, like programmed, that won't need it, period.
And covered CFLs are pretty much a whole category class would be below that line.
Correct. And from what I understand from the market research that we did, is that covered CFLs are going by the wayside. Manufacturers are phasing those out. Would you disagree with that?
Well, there's certainly a lower sales volume,
too.
But, okay.
Alex Bozenberg, NEMA, the trend, and perhaps it bears more analysis, is that some utilities are beginning to phase out rebate programs for standard CFL spiral because it's kind of old news, but they are still incentivizing specialty, the covered products in particular, CPUC, in fact, that's still part of their guidance. And so while the writing is on the wall that those will as phase out as well, it'll still be several years before everyone finished, especially the Midwest, where the last one stopped from the Midwest. So there's still opportunities there to offset incandescent sockets and have rebate programs restart to drive, but it's in these covered and specialty lamps.
So covered and specialty lamps also represent our highest volume of failures in verification testing. Time and time again, we found that covered lamps struggle to meet the requirements after fact. So, we are not encouraged to make exceptions to keep those products in particular in the program. I will say that this omnidirectional level that we set is ambitious, but it is to try to keep pace with how things are going. You can see there's a lot of products, a lot more products now that are over 100 lumens per watt.
Right.
And the mean efficacy is over 70 lumens per watt.
So the issue, you know, as Keith brought up before, is that you're really talking about two different technologies that are moving in two different directions. The CFL direction basically is flat. The LED direction is upward. And unless you recognize the differences in trajectories, you're saying that you're almost nearly eliminating CFLs from consideration as ENERGY STAR products. I think in this case, to Alex's point, you really need to talk to utilities who are probably the number one user of ENERGY STAR programs for rebate programs as what their reaction would be if there were very few CFLs left on the ENERGY STAR list. And if there's a demand, like I suspect based on Alex's input, there will be, you may have to recognize these two technological differences if you want to maintain a viable number, at least for a little bit longer, of CFLs on the marketplace. Because if this is, as you said, a real challenge to maintain CFLs on the ENERGY STAR list.
Absolutely. We do recognize that. And like I said, this is a starting off point for discussion. We have had preliminary feedback from efficiency organizations. Actually, to the contrary of what Alex Rosenberg was saying, which I know that is true that some are focused on specialty and less focused on bare spiral, but it was the opposite feedback, was that the bare spirals are the bread and butter of the programs for maintaining cost-effective savings, and perhaps if we were to lower the FC just a tad, it wouldn't allow those products back.
Hello, Taylor. This is Austin. I also did want to remind folks that we are talking about an efficacy level that is still a ways out as well. So,
yeah.
So, Dave,
just two quick things in here. One is that when you analyzed these, I know you had some specific things you looked at from a utility standpoint, but one of the things when we kind of took a look from our end was that particularly in CFL, the lower wattage lamps have a tougher time because there's some components that are power consumers that as you go down in wattage, they stay flat, so it affects efficacy. So there are some 8, 9, 10, 11-watt CFL bare spirals that I would agree in the Midwest, we still see Wisconsin's only funding CFL, no LED for the residential market. I would have a concern, and I think some of the utilities, and it might be what you were getting from Taylor, is that if you set that bar even a little bit too high, you're going to put part of the country at risk of backsliding from an efficiency standpoint. I think the other thing is if the covered lamps are failing, then I would assume that's getting cleaned up to an extent in the verification testing. I know we get plenty of those. So I'm not sure just having updated the specification, I think part of why you updated it was to remove some of those products that weren't holding up to the ENERGY STAR expectation.
Well, it's not really even that. We're looking at continuously recognizing the most efficient products in the market. And the covered ones, not only do they experience...
But they're lower efficiency in CFL in particular.
Exactly.
Okay, that's
yeah. Yeah, but of course, this is the starting point, mm-hmm. and this feedback discussion is very helpful for moving forward. Anthony, I'll take yours, and we might have some on the line.
Anthony Sayers, Lucidity. In response to Mr. Gelder's comment, you know, you showed a Q1 effective date, and products that are being designed now and put into testing will finish their testing about Q1 of 2016, so it's really difficult to design a product and all of a sudden, when it's coming out of testing, the criteria change, so to speak.
Well, in terms of effective date, right? So,
in terms of effective date,
you can we encourage folks to design to a final specification, right? And you have that period of time before it's effective to
right.
do that.
Right. But there are products that are being designed now, right? Everyone probably has products that are in process, and they go into testing in the near future. They'll be finishing their testing when the effective listing becomes effective, which is problematic. I mean, because then you're telling people, oh, wait to design the product until they have the final spec or something.
Yeah, well, so that's great feedback in terms of, to include in your comments for our effective date and timeline. We've been very flexible in the past considering the long testing timelines that these products are subject to. anything on. I just want to be cautious at this time.
Yep. We have two questions asking about analysis of 60 and 40 watt equivalent CFL lamps. One of them from Claire Mizzle at the NEEP mentioned that many CFLs were hitting right at 69 lumens per watt and not at 70, and that lower that would be beneficial. Also from Claire Mizelek at NEEP, many efficiency programs are shifting away from specialty CFL support but have funding allocated to support standard CFLs for several years and would be worried about to not have ENERGY STAR qualified products available.
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, this is a great discussion. I mean, we recognize the passing rates by technology, and even if we were to lower it to, say, 68 lumens per watt, that would increase the CFL's passing rate to nearly 50%. So we absolutely are open to all this great feedback, and thank you all for discussion. And I guess I just will mention also to Al's question earlier about the CRI products, looking at CRI in terms of the efficacy levels that we've set. While we do have very low numbers of high CRI data, like 90-plus CRI, it's only about 7% of total lamps today, but 70% of those products have efficacies of 65 lumens per watt or greater. Okay, so let's move on to the other graph to show the directional lamp. So you see the mean of these products is 66.7 lumens per watt. We're looking at a 65 lumens per watt level, which would maintain roughly 57% of certified lamps today. And yes, this is one area that CFL cannot meet.
Okay. Well, it's clear that this area is being dominated by LED technology. Sure. LEDs do a better job. So I guess if manufacturers know they can't hit it with CFLs, it's a level playing field. There won't be any ENERGY STAR CFLs that are reflector lamps. But
thank you, Joe Holly from GE. Okay. And then decorative products. Next, we've also set this level for draft one proposed at 65 lumens per watt. Mean is 66.2 lumens per watt. You'll see probably just a couple CFL decorative products that can meet this level in there.
Taylor, Dave Gatto, Westinghouse Lighting. Thank you. Tom would have reminded me. Within this product category, when you did the analysis, there's quite a bit of red below the bar, and I'm guessing that's because we all have the same challenge with size and directionality for the decorative lamps, particularly to replace 40 to 60 watt incandescent lamps for all kinds of things, chandeliers, fan light kits, things like that. And this may go to what you were saying earlier, so I'm probably a little bit more comfortable than I was when I first saw it. Are you open to the idea that there's still a place where it would still effectively eliminate CFL, which I would admit we're moving away from in this particular specialty shape, but that allows the products that are hitting both the efficacy that you're looking for and the price point and functionality, particularly dimming, that the consumers are looking for?
We would love to have that feedback. We don't have as much price data. Another bit of data we don't have is the full intensity distribution of these products. So all we know is whether they hit or not the current requirement. So if you're going above and beyond and trying to hit omnidirectional, you may have, despite the fact that the omnidirectional products are the most efficient products on the omnidirectional side.
Here's where it's
different for the size and it's different for R&D. I know most of R&D is driven towards the omnidirectional products right now, and this is maybe a secondary category, but I do want to point out that there are a variety of different sizes and functionality in terms of dimming, very high efficacious products in this category.
Joe Howley from GE. I noticed as I look in the chart that there is a fairly large groups of red dots just below the 65. And my guess would be those are probably a lot of the lower wattage decorative lamps, and this may be one category where you want to keep the wattage split because
maybe.
It's
we're also
so
talking
difficult.
About 2016, so I mean,
but
keep that in mind,
yeah.
Future targets, but we are. This is our starting point, so we're. If you can provide us with some detailed ratio of specific product types, cost points, performance features,
I think the challenge here is that, and this may be where Joe was, Dave got a Westinghouse Lighting, when you get into the under four and a half watts, you're back to, especially if you've got dimming, there are some components that are required that have their own power requirements that simply, they take a much bigger percentage of the total power, which can throw efficacy off. So,
Alex Bosenberg, Nima, Taylor, to your previous last statement about the various wattages, et cetera, above the line, if you will. What I've noted down to ask my members is to give feedback on whether the variety of lamps at that recommended efficiency level can be maintained in terms of what the market demands in terms of shape, size, and performance.
We did look at that, but your second look and absolutely would be very valuable.
The other thing that may influence is where are you going with power factor on this?
We haven't touched power factor. We're not proposing any changes to power factor.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. We did anticipate efficacy to be the probably the biggest topic of discussion. We're at 10 minutes to 3. I'll just take one more moment to make sure that people on the phone or on the webinar don't have any more comments or questions to add to the topics that we've covered this far.
There's a question on section 5.1 if you want to touch back on
okay.
That.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. If a lamp at non-default – oh, this is from Jim Gaines. If a lamp at non-default white points is more efficient but also more consumptive than default, only power at maximum point is reported?
No, we're looking at power at maximum point reported, but that doesn't mean that that's where all the testing needs to take place. It's just a reported value that we're capturing. We're also capturing the default setting, and then we're capturing the least efficient setting if it's different. So it you don't have to necessarily test at all these points. Maybe I'd have to read this question again.
That's why I said you'd include in our comments.
Okay, well, I don't want to take up too much time today, but I'm sure I will address it when the time comes. But all right, so if there's no more comments, I'm going to pass it over to Austin. To
talk about elevated temperature light-out ratio,
section 9.3.
Absolutely. Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit. 9.2. We'll get to 9.3. Don't worry. So for section 9.2 with light output, there's really not a lot of changes here. The one significant change is it's not one that would require any additional testing. Just looking at the report would be that. EPA believes it would be valuable to decision makers for MR and PAR lamps in addition to the CBCP and the equivalency there to also have a total light output. And this is also consistent with the FTC labeling. I mean, you have to have a light output anyways because we're talking about lumens per watt. So there is a proposal for that. Additionally, EPA has added some clarification regarding the evaluation of equivalency claims for three-way lamps. Noted that they'll be evaluated for equivalency based on the tested results at the highest input setting or the highest light output. Both of those are fairly straightforward. And we can move on to the next slide.
I want to pause and allow Noah Horwitz to ask you a question.
Yes.
Hi, this is Noah from NRDC. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Noah.
Hi, thank you. On section 9.2, it says three-way lamps shall be evaluated for equivalency claims based on test results at the highest input setting.
Mm-hmm.
So lamps are often saying they're 30, 70, 100 watt equivalent or 50, 100, 150.
Mm-hmm.
I agree they should have to meet the equivalency for the higher one, but why wouldn't they also have to meet the equivalency for the intermediate and low light output level?
Okay, so part of the consideration there is making sure to limit test burden, but that's also the evaluation at the highest light output is also consistent, really with the other lamps. So three-way could be considered in a sense a step dimming, and dimming lamps are also evaluated for equivalency at the highest light output.
Yeah, we would recommend, and we'll put in our comments, we think the other 2 points, their light output should be reported and they should be subject to the equivalency requirement. We're not saying that the lumen maintenance and all those other things need to be tested at the second and third points, but that's our input. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And the last point on section 9.2 that I was going to talk about, as Taylor had already mentioned, for consistency with the FTC reporting and DOE, we're proposing to remove initial light output tolerances from the specification. So let's move on to the next section. Now we are at section 9.3, elevated temperature light output ratio. So this is still applicable to all directional lamps, but what we are proposing is to include LM8214 as an alternate method of measurement for light output ratio testing of solid state lamps, and that's really just adding an additional option for determining if they meet the elevated temperature light output ratio. It's a standardized test, so. Section 9.4, we're talking about center beam intensity. It's PAR MR as well as MRX lamps. There are some clarifications simply because we've noticed in the lamps 1 specification that there was perhaps some room for interpretation. So we made clarifications that the measured center beam intensity value is what determines the equivalency claims, and all equivalency claims must align with the certified values. That includes things such as marketing and whatnot. All right, let's move on to the next section. Correlated color temperature. This is something we've heard a couple of comments from about lower correlated color temperature lamps. Specifically, we've heard in the range of the 2,000, 2,200, 2,500K type color temperatures. We understand that there is an ANSI spec for the lamps that is in the process of being updated. So what EPA is asking the stakeholders, but partners in particular, is there really consumer demand for these products? Is there really a quantified energy savings opportunity? And then, consistent with something that will be talked about a little bit later, what are some descriptors for colors? So we've got warm white is typically used to describe a 2700K. Would you call it really warm white? That seems like a really bad option, quite honestly. But, you know, there may be some better descriptor term for these colors for really developing consistent consumer understanding. Go to the next one. And consistent with the previous slide, this kind of transitions nicely in. For lamp packaging, EPA has proposed that the current color labeling, it's still confusing the consumers and believes it's still it's hindering the adoption. 27.3, 41, and they're all using different descriptions for these different color temperatures. So in this draft, EPA has proposed some specific nomenclature to be used with the packaging, so that the consumer can go in and say, "I need warm white," and they're going to get a consistent color of warm white. So as you can see on the screen, are some of the proposed nomenclatures need something perhaps for the 6500, as well as some of those lower CCTs. Should there be enough interest in those?
This is Al Safarikas from Cree.
Oh, okay. So I heard a whole bunch of people.
Apologies.
No, that's okay.
This is Al Safarikas from Cree. To the degree that there is any standard is too strong a word, but let's just say understanding around names for different color points, there are two very different groupings. There is one grouping that sort of exists to some degree around Edison-based lamps, and then there is a very different one for linears, right, formerly fluorescence only. Is the EPA and Energy Star thinking about the color labeling to help consumers understand universally? In other words, for linears, linear fluorescence and their LED equivalents, Edison-based, whether reflectors or omnidirectionals and their LED equivalents.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
I think to Al's question, we can only look to impact the products that are covered under our Energy Star specifications. And the real intent here is to, is not for us to dictate terms, marketing terms. It's simply to have them be consistent and eliminate consumer confusion. So while we have these terms proposed, these are based on what we could find was most consistently used in the market, but they're still not consistently used. So it was very challenging. Both 5,000 Kelvin and 6,500 Kelvin are both called daylight very consistently, which left us with what do we call that? The point here is that consumers have enough decision confusion when they're buying light bulbs today. Color is certainly one of them, and it continues to be a barrier to having a positive experience when people don't even know what it is, and the same terms are used for different colors. So the point here is simply for consistency's sake, not for us to dictate marketing terms. So we do look to our stakeholders to provide feedback on this proposal.
All right. Noting full well with my tongue firmly in cheek, I'd like to propose 6,500K be called Carolina Blue.
Jill Howley from GE. I think this is going to even produce further confusion based on historical industry use of these terms, because for 50, 60 years, we've used the term warm white to be 3,000 Kelvin, especially in the linear fluorescent category. We've used 3,000K warm white forever, probably since the 50s and for the last 60 years. We've used 2,700K to be soft white on our incandescent lamps for the last 60 years. So incandescent, soft white have always been 2,700. 3,000 has always been warm white. And today, I think most manufacturers still follow that that naming pattern that we've used for 60 years. Switching them for no apparent reason would be incredibly confusing to the market.
Like I said, we're not proposing to play these terms, but that was toss-up. Those terms are used very interchangeably.
The 60, I could take you back 50, 60 years.
In the market, they're used very interchangeably, and we picked 2,700 for warm because of the FTC label, because you see that number, that word when you're at 27 at that end. That's why we went there, because this is what the consumer has. The consumers, I say consumers don't even know what color temperature is. So while we've had industry practice for 50 or 60 years, consumers don't understand this, right? So we have, I think, an opportunity to start fresh.
I think they do understand soft white's 2,700. They used incandescent soft for never. I think they understand that they get soft, they want it to be a warm, incandescent-like color, so incandescent that they measure. I think this would be a very big mistake to help them.
Again, the terms are not what we're after. We're after consistency.
So we would look
to NEMA probably to come back with the industry consensus for those terms.
Dave, got a question. I'm sliding. Even if we figure that one out, I would just want to go on record as 6,500K should be question. We'll just take that one. We'll go with it. We talked about this at the stakeholder meeting, the Energy Star Partners meeting. I appreciate you guys want to bring consistency, and I'm on board with that. We'll contribute to what NEMA is putting together, but this isn't going to fix it. Consumers, this stuff gets dumped off stock. I do have a more practical question, though, about this, which is the following. If we are currently carrying products that we're using, whatever we're using, which I think at 27 to 3,000 K, we're probably close to the industry standard. But when you get above that, it probably plays right with it. Are there going to be a packaging requirement change? So now we're going to recertify. That's originally what I heard was, if the product's already basically meeting all the testing requirements, then you've got the paperwork associated with recertifying. This would potentially mean a major packaging change, which I think for new products wouldn't really have an objection to that. And is that where you're going? Because if we had to repackage things, especially in LED, where by the time we repackage, that product may not exist anymore.
Yeah, I think so. I understand the impact that packaging changes have, and we would consider some flexibility in terms of how to achieve packaging requirements. There is certainly a kind of product or a help over time to apply packaging.
Thanks. Alex, just for the record, also in a big label packaging discussion, California, which is, it makes yours look like foam. But to deconflict those as much as possible is all my continued goal.
One was, or one's more of a comment from Edward Bartholomew, saying lamp packaging names do not matter to consumers, and it'll cost manufacturers to repackage the lamps. A question from Noah Horowitz of NRDC. What would a manufacturer do if they in between 56?
Well, right now, we only cover the nominal bins that we have here. So if they're close to one, they'd have to fall into one of the bins. Anyone with their hand raised on the webinar, feel free to unmute your line by pressing *6, and remember, this is being recorded, and to announce your name and your organization.
Hi, Taylor, this is Jim Gaines from Philips. I think it's going to stay confusing no matter which words we use to describe CCT, so my suggestion is that Energy Star not require the use of words, whether Energy Star standardizes them or not. So leave the option for the manufacturer just to use Kelvin if he wants.
This is Roy Harvey at Azure, Sylvania. And regarding the labels, I concur with the earlier comment. But also, the packages are getting pretty busy. I'm not sure if this is discussed already, but if we add more verbiage, we'll probably have to take off something that might better guide the consumer to a good choice.
Thanks, Roy. I mean, we're not trying to propose any additions. We're just trying to harmonize what's already being done, because what's being done is not harmonized currently.
Alex Baker, Phillips Lumilez. I think you know that I have an appreciation for how difficult it is to get your hands on data, real data of the market. Osram, Sylvania does us a favor annually by doing a lot of surveys, and you know, most recently they published their Discover LED Lighting Survey. One of the conclusions from that was other areas of satisfaction include brightness of the bulb, 90%, the color of the bulb produces, 89%. That's sort of inconsistent with a feeling that consumers are confused about CCT. So I guess I would encourage you to explore some of that data a little further.
Sure, we can do that. It's a very small sample size, that study.
This is Al Safarikas from CRE. Just because someone doesn't like something doesn't mean he doesn't know what it is.
So with that, I think we'll move on to make sure we can cover this and not keep everyone here forever. So I'll
okay.
Pass it back to Austin to touch on Section 9.7 changes.
Okay, so the Section 9.7 color rendering, the only proposed change is the harmonized LED and CFO and require the R9 to simply be positive. So 82% of the lamps on the certified product list have, you know, they already meet this. In terms of those that actually meet the efficacy requirements, 96% of those lamps meet this as well.
So the point here is we don't think this is a really big impact to the market based on our analysis. And it would be holding the technology to the same level.
So, Taylor, Joe Howley with GE. A question, when you say 96% meet, is that after you've eliminated 70% of the lamps by pushing the efficacy bar way up, that of what's remaining, the 32% remaining, 96%, 30%.
82% of lamps, all lamps certified today meet this requirement. 96% of the lamps that meet the new proposed efficacy.
So if you take out LEDs from this, because that's distorting the data. What's that? 4%?
No, there are CFLs that meet this requirement. It's
sure,
not,
sure, yeah. I know. There, CFLs have, well,
but
there's different colors in CFLs.
Right, but these are just, this is the sheer percent of products that are certified today. It's 96%.
Keith Cook with Phillips. But the problem is as we drive the R9 up, it is going to drop the efficacy down, which means that the CFLs that we're meeting it may not meet it now.
If you were going to change them to meet this requirement.
Right.
Yeah. I think you're going to end up with a lot of the lamps that weren't meeting it were CFLs that were spirals, the ones the utilities want to keep rebating. And by adding R9 to those products, especially the 2700K products, which are the bread and butter of this program, it is going to decrease the efficiency of them even further or make it more difficult to hit these levels. I'm just, it adds an extra complication to making CFLs meet.
Right.
The CFLs that do tend to meet this, if you look at the list, tend to be like the daylight that have to hit for R9 because the phosphor mix is different, not the ones that are typically used. So this does have an important impact on CFLs that if they had to be redesigned to meet very high efficiency levels, an extra challenge, but feeds back into perhaps why the efficiency levels are too high if you want to maintain CFLs on the Energy Star program. Anyway, I'll add that in there.
Okay, thank you for your comment.
Online, Noah Horwitz, NRDC. Did you explore a higher R9 for LEDs given the high pass rate for this parameter for LEDs given 90% already?
We didn't explore raising the R9 requirement for LED lamps. We feel that this is an area that we think that manufacturers can differentiate. So our level, we felt comfortable maintaining a positive R9 requirement here and then leaving it up to industry to differentiate at that point. You also noticed, like, we present this information on our qualified product list for the people who know enough to look for it or want to look for it. It's there, but we feel that the positive requirement is sufficient for our minimum levels. Okay, back to you, Austin. Color maintenance.
Yep, we'll go right on to color maintenance. So some of the feedback we've gotten, just again over time, has been some concern about color shift after the 6,000 hours of evaluation. Now, not proposing to necessarily extend a lot more color. What the proposal is to extend the evaluation to all testing points. We're not adding additional testing points. The anticipation is that this information is captured when you're measuring for lumen maintenance. So as color maintenance is specific to LEDs, if you've tested your lamp for 6,000 hours, there's really no change there. If you've tested it out to 12,000 hours, instead of you just look at a different area of the report to say, okay, the color point has not extended outside of that seven-step macadam ellipse. So there's really not, it's not an additional testing burden, merely an additional point that will be evaluated by certification or in recertification.
And also the graph here, I'll point out, shows some recent DOE work on long-term color maintenance data. And you see, for the most part, the lamps, most of the lamps are just fine underneath that threshold. So we don't really anticipate this to be a huge problem. It also shouldn't be a huge burden because it's already captured, but it would capture those few outliers that are going off the rails after a certain point and really changing color. So just slight addition, addition value to testing that it's already being.
Exactly. All right. No comments. We'll move on to lumen maintenance requirements. So for lumen maintenance requirements, as was discussed earlier, adding references to the final Department of Energy LED test procedure. In doing so, anticipating removing tolerances for the lumen maintenance and that all units would be included in the average calculations for lumen maintenance. Move on to the next one. Consistent with Energy Star luminaires, added a reference for the TM21 calculator. That comes into play when a lamp is going for the early initial certification, and added some supplemental testing guidance for items to be included in the TM21 report. And additionally, added some guidance for determining a lumen maintenance estimate for the color tunable lamps. If you're doing any projections on color tunable lamps, the TM21 for all of the LED colors need to meet the requirement, not just one color, since you can't really separate those out. Move on to the next one. All right, so consistently ambient testing is proposed only for lamps labeled not for use in totally enclosed recessed. Bless you. Recessed fixtures on the lamp and the lamp packaging. Again, it's just a clarification. And we'll move on to the next slide. Lumen maintenance included some instructions that were previously in the appendix for the early certification for CFLs, just providing additional clarification and making sure it's very clear how CFLs can get on the early certification. At a proportion of rated lifetime.
Yeah, to be clear, there's no change here. It's just
no.
We just relocated the information.
Put it where you're more likely to look for it, really. That was a very quiet section for lumen maintenance. I don't know that, do we have any questions online?
We have one in the room.
We have run in the room. I'm excellent. Who is that? What's that question in the room?
Hey, Austin. It's Tom Sinek from GE. Can you go back one?
Yeah.
Since we've talked that CFLs are slowly going away, one question I have for this is, can we start to look at the actual early certification procedure for LED lamps instead of waiting to 3,000 hours for the complete lamp?
That is the early certification.
I know, but the question some of us think that 3,000 hours may be a little bit late for early certification. And based on where the LED market is and how fast it is moving, the question is, do we have to really wait the 3,000 hours on the final LED lamp itself, specifically if we have TM20 and the other adjustments that we made?
So you want earlier certification?
I'm asking for early certification at like 1,000 hours on an LED lamp, based on having TM21 data. Since we're basically taking away any tolerances we have on any testing, right? And now we have to just continuously wait. The real question I have is, and you guys will have this data more than I will have, but if I was to look at how many lamps failed at 3,000 hours versus 6,000 hours for LED lamps, I would expect it to be a small amount. And the real question I would have is if we could entertain the thought going to a smaller number of hours for early certification.
Okay, thank you for that comment. I think what's going to be particularly helpful and interesting to see, you know, is what DOE finalizes with their test method for how to rate products like and how the testing and compliance with that is going to play out for you, and then we'll wait to see what that is, and then we can maybe consider other options.
This is another portion of this. This is Phil Thompson from GE. The actual data from the first set of, or the LED testing that has gone over, I think for the last 2 years, do we have an idea when some of that will be available for review?
Yeah, we're compiling all of our 2014 verification testing data now.
Okay.
And so I hope to be able to share that publicly at some time this spring. In a webinar, probably. I was hoping to do it for the April 20th meeting, but I don't know if it'll be ready by then.
Thank you.
We have a question online from James Dagan. For early and final certification, have there been any changes to the allowed number of failures?
Yes. The proposal now requires all samples to be surviving for LED bulbs, which is consistent with the latest supplemental notice of proposed rulemaking that DOE put out. But, again, that is subject to change, and we will be watching that.
Okay. Well, if that's all the questions, we will continue on to the next slide, which is the rapid cycle stress test. So this is definitely a change. Remove the requirement for LED products to undergo the rapid cycle stress test. The rapid cycle stress test was designed to test a specific failure mechanism in CFLs, and based on the data that we have, the test is not found to appropriately stress the LED driver electronics. As such, if it's not appropriately stressing or adequately stressing the electronics, it doesn't seem logical to keep it in. So EPA will consider, however, including an appropriate stress test or accelerated test or anything along those lines for solid-state products once one is developed. Unfortunately, there's just really not one right now. I understand that there is definitely work going on in that area, but when that gets finalized is still a bit up in the air. All right. Move on to electrical requirements. All right, so for electrical safety, there is a small note on the connected products, is that the connected products must continue to comply with appropriate safety standards, regardless of what the controller tells it to do. So this really shouldn't be a problem. It's really more of just a statement to keep in mind. We'll move on to the next. So for power factor, again, this is not a change in power factor requirement, merely updating to the most recent test method for both solid state and CFL lamps, CA2.77. We'll continue on. So for frequency, again, not a change in the requirement, but there is a change in the supplemental testing guidance. Provides a little bit more information on what some helpful equipment or what the equipment parameters would be that would be able to actually measure the waveforms and help determine what that frequency is. All right. And we'll move on to 11.4, start time. So start time, there is a change in the start time requirement. So the change in the start time requirement proposed is actually not shown up here, but is going to be a half second. Of that half second, there is a significant portion of the currently certified products that will meet that. Even reducing to that half second, 95% to 97% of most of your categories will meet it. The only exception is the decorative, of which a mere 86% will actually meet that start time.
Austin.
Yes.
This is Matthew Reynolds from Cree. I understand the chart that you have, the illustration on the presentation.
But really, what does this tell us? I mean, it shows us that we most of the products on the market now meet the requirement, but why change? What's the impetus between changing this? Is this really a problem that we're trying to solve? And I can tell you what this relates to after you're done answering that question.
Sure. So, Taylor, if you want an answer, that's fine. Otherwise, I will make a go of it.
Yeah, I will also just clarify that this is of products that meet the proposed efficacy levels. These are the passing rate of products once you take it into account, the efficacy levels. We always try to, with ENERGY STAR specifications, recognize the most efficient products in a given category that aren't going to sacrifice performance. So, you know, with that being said, consumers really do expect instant light, instant on light. And when we talk about the category we're talking about here today are light bulbs. And so getting closer to a traditional light bulb experience is what we're looking for, minimizing that sacrifice in performance. We also don't see it as a huge impact to the current product certified because many are performing at that level. But I am interested to hear, Matt, a little bit more about what you want to comment on this requirement.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, first of all, is this really a problem? Has this been brought to someone's attention that, you know, I mean, I understand with CFLs, they can start kind of slow and there's a warm-up time, and that's not what we want to, you know, that's not what we're trying to regulate here, but it's more like with solid-state lighting. You know, the difference between less than a 1 second and less than 500 milliseconds, is it really an issue? Are we really trying to solve a problem? And the reason I ask this is because you can look at some of these specifications individually, and you can make the requirements more stringent, but sometimes you'll get into a point where they become mutually exclusive, many of these requirements. You have very fast startup times, but then maybe you start talking about low ripple. And if you start looking at the nuances of designing these products, some of these things are not mutually exclusive. You can't make one requirement more stringent and not affect another requirement. And I don't know how much time people have thought about, you know, as you look at one of these individually, how they affect the other. And I can start to see a trend here on some of these requirements becoming more and more stringent, but when you put it together as a system, you're going to actually possibly do more harm than good. So question is, are you really solving a problem here, or do you see that this is an opportunity just to make a requirement that, you know, more stringent, that doesn't really matter out there in the field? I'm curious about how much work has been done.
Well, we did consider it in conjunction with the other requirements, but we don't always have, you know, access to the information that you as a manufacturer do to look at compounding effects of all the requirements when we look at them. But we did look at them. We did try our best to look at them all layered together and to see how the various requirements impact one another. But I'm sure you have additional insight as a manufacturer. I will say it's not the most important problem to solve. It's a simple annoyance, I think, for most consumers. But it's something we thought we had an opportunity to tighten up. But all your feedback is very helpful for the discussion for us to consider as we move forward. Keith
Cook, Phillips. This will be another blow, though, for the CFL program start type lamps because they are designed specifically for the program start for rapid cycle type applications. And now they're no longer going to be able to meet it, so that whole product will disappear, essentially. So now people are going to have early failures to the CFLs, which will add to further discomfort to that whole product line.
Dave Gowdy, Westinghouse. I'm kind of where Keith is, and it might have been what the gentleman from Cree was talking about. When you look at efficacy, there's a small number of CFLs that make it. And then you look at CRI, positive R9, and there's some CFLs that make it. And when you look at startup time, and there's some CFLs that make it. I think if you applied all of the, if you looked at what was in each of those buckets, they're not in the other buckets. At least that's a concern I would have, particularly for CFL. You know, the rapid cycle testing, we shorten, you know, can we get it down here? Yes, but now it's not going to qualify for ENERGY STAR because it's going to fail the rapid stress test, or it's going to end up coming up in a verification testing cycle and then coming off the marketplace, which is disruptive for both of us. So I don't know. I think that we'll obviously we'll give you our feedback, Taylor, but one of the things that you may want to consider is whether or not, whether you're going to share it with us directly or not, whether or not you want CFLs to have a place within the specification. And if you do, then obviously from the manufacturing standpoint, we can give you the feedback on where that give and take is, because I appreciate that it may not be as obvious to you as it is to some of us. If, on the other hand, you really want, other than some specific products that might need it anyway to stay in, that would be useful to know. If really that's the direction, then we would want to know about it. We can accept and move on, but we won't spend as much energy on what it's going to take to provide the feedback you need, if that makes sense.
Sure, that's helpful feedback.
Yeah, this is Howard Wolfman. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
An observation and then another observation from my own family room. The challenge that you're facing is having common set of requirements for two different technologies and trying to maintain both technologies. As you make the requirements more and more stringent, that may eliminate one of the technologies, and that's, I think, the fundamental thing that people are concerned about, is simply eliminating CFLs. If that's the goal, then just raise everything so they're eliminated. I'm not suggesting that, though. A comment from my family room when it has to do with start time is I have some BR-30s recessed from two of the companies that are in the room right now, and when I turn on our power switch, one comes on immediately, the other one has a significant detectable delay before it comes on. And they've both been that way since they came out of the box, and they're still that way after about 6 months.
And does that bother you, Howard? Does that make you angry?
On the record, Howard.
See how the life compares of the two.
Somebody asked me to identify
the two.
Would somebody like me to identify the two companies? I won't do it.
No, they're already finger pointing in the room.
No, we already know where you live.
Thank you, Howard. Anyone else on start time?
There's a question from Claire Mizula. Is the start time listed on the QPL?
It is, yeah.
Okay.
Wait. No, I think we got rid of it. Sorry. It is not.
It would be helpful information to have to understand the impact of the change. Start time.
We can probably make a data set available that includes start time and run-up time and post it on the product development page.
And speaking of run-up time, we can move on to the next slide.
Yeah, go for it, Austin.
So for CFL run-up time, again, we've got a chart, and you'll notice that there is a specific type of bar missing from this particular graph, and that is the directional lamps. The directional lamps for the requirements are just not going to meet the appropriate start time requirement. And I apologize, that's actually not on this graph, but that's 60 seconds. Now, likely this is due to the high heat nature of the directional CFLs, but again, other directional or other products that are not directional, the vast majority of them are meeting the run-up time of 60 seconds, 99% of the omnidirectionals, and even 82% of the decorative types are meeting this.
These are run-up time results after the proposed efficacy levels are taken into account. And we wanted to point out that in our note box in the draft, we had cited 89% of CFLs
meeting efficacy
requirements, and that was incorrect. It's actually 97%.
So, Dave got a Westinghouse, I think. Do you know what the number of models that would be?
We do. Get that for you?
Thank you.
You may have to look that one up real quick.
I imagine that most of the covered CFLs would have a hard time meeting this, but what you're saying is this chart does not include covered CFLs because you're assuming they're already wiped out by the efficiency requirement.
Well,
no, it includes
that. No, this includes them. It's just the directional covered CFLs don't meet the requirement.
The regular covered CFLs, not the
depth. The omnidirectional.
So that is omnidirectional.
It could be included. I mean, 99% there. So if that... If they're meeting.
If they meet the efficiency, which
right,
most of
then
them,
meeting
most of them would not meet the efficiency, so they would be in this data set. So
right,
what you're saying, Anthony, is you're covered CFLs. You're only considering them as decorative, not as just omnidirectional.
In this, Anthony said specificity, I think that most of the decorative product would not meet the efficacy requirements. So we're only seeing like 80%.
The remaining.
But the remaining, that's why it's filtered like it is. There's an efficacy filter for draft one put on this to begin with. And I think most of the covered product would be considered decorative.
Dave Gatter-Westing, it's like you've got the A-shape and the globe that are probably omnidirectional, but the decorative, part of why I asked the model question is I'm surprised there's any decorative on there, and if there are,
they're
LED.
This is CFL. That's why I asked.
No, this is all lamps.
But it says CFL on the type.
Sorry, okay. Of course, it's all LEDs lamps. Don't have a run-up time required, so of course it's all CFL. that's right. I'm on start time. We're on run-up time here, and it's only applicable to CFL. So, yes, this is all CFLs meeting the proposed efficacy levels. And so we can definitely get you those numbers based on what these show, because, yes, the numbers are very small, because the number of CFLs that meet the efficacy levels are very small to begin with. So, yeah.
Okay.
A very small subset.
How about five? Well, and I'm actually, again, on decorative, I said it earlier, I'm not as concerned about the decorative categories as I am with Omni. I just, when you see 82 or 92%, it can be misleading if that's 12 or 15 or 20 products. So,
sure. Yep, we can provide you with the actual number of lamps that we have.
Okay, so moving on to the next one, which is the standby power. This is for the connected type products, consistent with many of the other changes that we're doing. We're referencing the DOE LED test procedures, allowing a half watt in the off state.
Hey, Canada Westinghouse. Is this the supplemental testing guidance? Is this what you were talking about earlier, Taylor, where you're going to, currently this reads all elements? We're going to change it to instructions.
So later on, it was our oversight.
Oh, that's okay.
The description was written three different times in the specification. We only changed it one time later on in section 12.7, and we will update this section in supplemental testing guidance as well, along with the definition.
Perfect.
To be consistent with our intent there.
Thank you.
We have a question on coloring the uniformity, if you want to do it.
If we can hold that till the end, because it's not a topic that we're actually covering today, but we certainly can speak about it at the end. if there's no mind. Want to make sure we cover everything today.
All right. Moving on to controls. So move on to the next slide. So, for Section 12 controls requirements, this is a new section added for lamps with connected functionality. This is a section that was added consistent with Luminaire's 2.0 Draft 1. It's kind of touching base. It's back on the product may not consume more than a half watt in the standby mode, and we'll kind of continue on from this particular slide, and we get into a little bit more of the details of the control requirements for connected products. Next slide. There we go. All right, so there is a section that includes some of the controls requirements. This is based partially off of some of the existing connected criteria for other Energy Star product categories, scaled back, modified, what you all for use with lamps, where and lighting where maybe some of the requirements are different. So this simply explains where the connected criteria should have the elements or instructions. As you can see, this part of the definition is right back in the supplemental testing guidance that needs to be updated. Provided a couple of examples. Yes.
Keith Cook with Phillips. In section 12.7, we're looking for a little clarity there. Does energy-related commands include commands to change color or light output, or does it simply imply that the lamps must respond to a third-party command, like demand response commands from a utility?
I think we expect it to include all of those types of commands. But we do, you know, this is very new for lighting, and we do really want lots of comments on how, you know, this is or is not appropriate or how this needs to be reshaped to properly support and reflect what's hitting connected lighting products in the market. The biggest thing about this whole section is that we want to encourage open standards, interoperability, and open access.
And Phil supports that too.
So, okay. Great. Do we have any other comments on this slide before we move on to the next one?
We have a question about standby power. Claire Mizulek, how do you intend to deal with the standby power that may be involved for connected lamps with hubs or gateway that use energy, but it would be the same amount of energy for one lamp or 50?
So, at this time, we're only looking, like, because this is a lamp specification, our focus is on the lamp power. There's also, from my understanding, less of a dependence on bridge and hubs. There's a variety of different connected types of lamps out there. Some use hubs, some don't. The hubs have their own power consumption, yes, that is constant, I believe, depending on how many lamps you put on. But we're only looking at limiting the power of the individual lamp for this specification at this time. That's our focus.
Okay. So let's go ahead and move on to our next slide. All right. So our next slide, we're focusing on these are some of the control requirements that we have just as this is in place. Energy consumption reporting, basically how, we get some communication on how much energy is using all of its energy, half its energy, whatnot. Operational status, that could be something as simple as on and off, or if available, color and intensity. What color is it? Is it at 50% dim? That sort of thing. Remote management, shall be capable of responding to an energy management system or other consumer authorized remote requests.
Hey, Austin?
Yes.
It's Keith Cook from Phillips again. The way that reads, it almost makes it sound like the lamp is supposed to keep record of how much energy it's used over some period of time.
Okay, so you're talking about 12.10, right?
No, 12.9.
Oh, 12.9. I'm sorry. I apologize for that. Said the wrong thing. Okay, I do not believe, Taylor, I do not, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe the intent is for the lamp to record and store that data.
Record and store? Specifically, it's to report, not necessarily record. Which section are you referring to?
Well, 12.9. The data shall record in 1 hour. For intervals of 15 minutes, which makes it sound like it's keeping it every 15 minutes.
It doesn't necessarily need to be maintained. It would just be reported. And, of course, this is the kind of stuff we want your feedback on. This is taken from other Energy Star specs as a starting point. So we really do want to hear your feedback on how this meshes with.
Yeah, this is Matthew Reynolds from Cree. This sounds an awful lot like a commercial requirement. I'm not sure where this came from, but it doesn't seem to be applicable to the connected lamps that are on the market today. I would definitely need some clarity, or Cree would need some clarity on this. It makes little to no sense to myself or many others.
It was derived from our other ENERGY STAR specifications connected criteria. So refrigerators is one example. And if this isn't appropriate for lighting, then we absolutely want to hear your feedback about that.
This is Roy Harvey at Osmo Sylvania. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I'd just like to concur with the thoughts of the other manufacturers. This seems to have been based on the requirements for the pool pumps, refrigerators, and other kind of heavy, big iron appliances that it might be consuming horsepower or, you know, kilowatts of electricity. For a lamp, it's down, you know, around 10 watts. It just seems like overkill. And it also seems that the definition of connectivity here is outside the house, in other words, to a utility for demand response. There are many opportunities for energy savings inside the house for a connected product. For example, occupancy sensor or light sensor to switch the light on or off or to dim it. So it seems to me that requiring the external connectivity and all this reporting and so on is a big burden for a simple lamp. Certainly interesting features, but I think at the base level for connected lamps, it would just not be consistent with the products that are out there now. We're just trying to get this market started with the connected lighting. We don't want to put too high a hurdle in its path.
Thank you for your comment.
Okay, so great. I guess I'll kind of continue with the remote management. Basically, you know, the lamp needs to respond to some sort of remote management, be it, you know, the hardwired or applications or whatnot. And information to consumers is really making sure consumers know what is the lamp compatible with. Really helping them understand compatibility so that if they're purchasing products, they know what's going to work with what, essentially. So we're going to move to the next section, the next page, which actually has some questions for the folks in the room as well as the folks online. This is kind of an emerging thing for these controls. What are stakeholders envisioning for the operational status reporting? Really, it's to assist in enabling, you know, consumer desired features. How might the spec reflect this? What are the stakeholders' thoughts on third-party remote management as connects to various aspects of connected criteria? Which, if any, of the current solutions are already enabling this? In terms of, in particular, energy consumption and operational status. I'm sure there's more beyond this that could be described or could be explored. Again, this is very new, so EPA is certainly requesting feedback on what are the desired features, what can be done, that sort of thing. Okay. No questions? Or are there any, I guess, before we get into this next steps, are there any other questions, comments, anything along those lines about the connected criteria? Do we have anything on the online questions?
Austin, this is Jim Gaines from Philips.
Hello, Jim.
I don't really know enough to give good, solid answers to these.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know who to ask, so
okay.
I think we can get some input on these for you, and I imagine other people on the phone are in the same position.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jim Gaines from Philips. We look forward to hearing all your feedback on Connect. I know it's very new and evolving, and we really do hope to see a lot of great feedback on the connected stuff. You know, we're just dipping our toes in this. I know a lot of you are as well. So let's work together to mold just the right amount of requirements that, you know, really benefit the consumer and the stakeholders that are investing in this program. So I did, we do have a comment from Noah Horowitz. Noah, can you unmute your line?
Just give us the comment.
Yes, can you hear me?
We can hear you, yes.
Great, thank you. Could you go back to the slide on run-up time, please, that showed the percent meeting it?
Sure.
Great. My understanding is the current requirement is 90 seconds, is that right?
For covered lamps, it's 60 seconds for bare lamps.
Barely 120, sorry.
2 minutes for covered, 1 minute for bare lamps. And we do have those numbers, 101 omnidirectional lamps. 90 represents that 99%, and that 82% of decorative is 9.
So. I'm sorry, for bare lamps, what's the current requirement?
Yes, run-up time.
You cut out, I'm sorry.
60 seconds or less for bare lamps, 120 seconds or less for coverage.
And most of the conversation seemed to be a recognition that we do want to preserve CFLs, and the focus would be to keep the omnis and the bare lamps included at a minimum. And as I look at this, this is very high levels of pass rates for the omnis or bare lamps. And it's really no different than where we were in the 90s, and maybe it's 1% difference. And if you go all the way down to 30, over half of the lamps already meet this. And in terms of, to the extent that there's a dissatisfier for consumers with CFLs, we believe in looking at data from various surveys that they think the bulbs are too dim, or what they're often saying is it takes too long for the thing to come on or full brightness. We spoke earlier about the start time, and I think we agree with other people in the room that once you're down to 1 second, you're probably okay. The bigger concern would be run-up time. So we would like to see more data on the 30 milliseconds. That should be seconds, not milliseconds, right, on the bottom?
Yes, that should be seconds. Apologies.
Yeah.
Apologies for that. No, that'd be a really, really fast run-up time, and those numbers would be very different.
Sure. So even at 30 seconds, it looks like over half of the bulbs that you're trying to focus on for the CFLs would meet this. And I'm wondering if there's any more granularity on that. In particular, are those primarily the hybrid bulbs like GE has, where it's got a halogen inside, or is it just a plain vanilla CFL? And if it is, we'd like to see moving beyond the status quo of 60 seconds for bare down to some smaller number.
Thanks, Noah. I think what I got from the feedback that we've received from both startup time and run-up time proposals is that people would like to see a little bit more granular analysis, and we're happy to provide that. We'll do that hopefully before the end of the comment period, and we'll try to get that up on the product development page for everyone to take a look at in the next couple weeks.
And I'm sympathetic to the point that each metric by itself, you might be able to meet it, but sometimes if you do better on one, it has a consequence on another. And I guess an open question to the manufacturers in the room, if one were to go to a faster run-up time, where's the price obtained? Does that mean a bigger chip or something else that gets negatively impacted? So I'm unaware of that. Other than potentially cost.
Keith Cook and Phillips, no, the big trade-off on this one is lumen maintenance. I mean, we can dump more current into the thing to get the run-up time up faster, but it adversely affects life.
And Taylor, going back to this 55% and 57 numbers, those are products that already meet the current lumen maintenance requirements, right?
Yes, and efficacy. But keep in mind that that's about 50 models.
And Steve Gatter, Westinghouse, and this is, I'm glad you're going to provide the additional granular data. What you may find is that all 50 are one wattage in three columns.
Yeah, well, we can absolutely.
Yeah, that would be the concern.
Take a look at that.
From 20 different manufacturers.
Right.
Yeah. Two different models.
all made the same. Thank you, Sarah Slusin. Point of clarification, these numbers are only filtered by the efficacy requirement, right, not the R9 requirement?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, yes.
Thank you, Taylor.
Yep, thanks, Matt.
Questions online from Sayori Mitsuhashi. Regarding 7.2 solid-state lumen maintenance, what will EPA propose if ANSI C78-377 is revised, especially for the program guidance in sections 4 and 5 for specified correlated color temperature?
Wait, lumen? Wait.
We're talking about color.
Yes, it's not color temperature. And EPA, well, EPA will probably just use C78-377.
This is the lumen maintenance status.
I thought that was the updated CCT. Although my understanding, and that document is not updated yet, finalized, but my understanding was that the updates were primarily to include two additional CCT bins, the 2200 Kelvin and 2500 Kelvin. I know there are already existing, what are they called, flexible bins, right?
Flexible CCTs.
Flexible CCTs, yeah. Right now, you know, our specification, we've only outlined the changes that we are looking at right now. We're looking for additional stakeholder feedback for other, you know, desired changes to consider based on market demand and energy savings.
I heard Section 4, Item 5, actually talking about the lumen maintenance guidance relevant to 22 and 2500 Kelvin and LME. Maybe you guys can discuss that offline, perhaps.
That they're essentially excluded.
Well, it's just
they would be covered by the current guidance.
The new CCTs are not in that guidance.
Right, right. So we don't have those CCTs proposed in the specification. We're not necessarily saying we're going to cover them. We brought them up today because we have heard from several stakeholders that they would like us to cover them. So whether or not if we decide to include them in the future, we would have to look at the greater impact that would have for the program. So thank you for that comment.
And Taylor, Joe Howley from GE. I understand there's actually four new color bins being discussed. They just had two different time frames, the 22 and 2500 on one time frame, but there's also a 2700 and 3000 white they're calling them. But these are color bins that are kind of meant to align to the new LRC studies suggesting consumers like a whiter light source, so industry's looking at
below the back body.
Formalizing bins below the back body where you could offer products that are fine bins below the back body that seem to have a consumer preference based on some LRC studies.
But to be clear, that's for your longer term considerations, not in this current revision.
And do we know an anticipated finalization of that answer?
Alex Baker, Phyllis Lumilez, the current ad hoc is considering the new CCT bins and a few other things. The next ad hoc, which would be convened once this revision is published, will then start to explore the creation of those new bins. So as for timing, I have no crystal ball, so.
Okay. So let me just be clear that currently we have no problem with products that can reach those CCTs. Those are perfectly eligible. Those 2200, 2500 Kelvin at a dim state, that's perfectly fine. And we're looking at right now, you know, just generally maintaining the color temperature bins that we have forward. But like I said, like Austin mentioned, we are, you know, we're open to stakeholder feedback in terms of importance of adding, expanding the scope for those products at full power at those CCT bins if it proves to be a boon for the market. So and energy savings. So if there is a big demand for it, we'd love to hear about that. So at this time, we'll just I'm just going to reiterate the timeline and open it up for discussion. Really, anything that you'd want to talk about. I know someone said they had a question about color angular uniformity. Certainly, we can talk about that. I don't really need to talk about this timeline. It's just there for reference. But please feel free to speak up if you have any questions about anything we proposed today or any additional comments that you'd like to make for us to consider as we revise LAMP version 2.0.
Taylor, this is Jim Gaines of Phillips. A question. These effective dates, do they depend on the DOE documents being published and in the Federal Register, or you'll go ahead without them?
We're going to closely monitor that process and adjust our specification accordingly to make sure that, that there are no conflicts for the manufacturers. If we end up finalizing before DOE finalizes, we can still make adjustments later on. We're just going to follow that process closely and do our best to keep up and align to avoid any conflicts.
So Taylor, on timeline, Joe Howley, GE. On timeline, I think we talked about this a little bit before, but the 9 months after release may be problematic for this. It depends on where you end up with all the other specs. So right now, as proposed, it's a challenge for CFL technology to meet all this. But if you change some of the specs, you know, maybe there's a different discussion. But as of right now, most of the CFLs, I mean, you're left with, you know, you heard one category, you had 9 products left, and you're custom. If manufacturers wanted to maintain it, that means the manufacturer, there's a lot of manufacturers on that list. You're talking maybe one product per manufacturer on average, one or two products per manufacturer that are still on that list. So they would have to, once the spec was final, they'd have to first determine whether they wanted to try to redesign to be. Again, it depends where it ends up. It may be so difficult manufacturers just give up, or maybe doable where they have to redesign it. It sounds like the utility's preference would be they'd like some spirals to remain on this list to continue their programs. But let's say they have to redesign a few things. The specs are set reasonable enough it could be made with some modifications that some manufacturers choose to do. You have design time, and that's probably a month or two to figure out what the design is, to test them out, and then you have to put them on test at a minimum of 4,000 hours. So that process is probably 9 to 10 months right there on top of the couple months design time. So, I mean, you're probably looking at least a year for these products to come back onto the market. Again, there's a lot of unknowns here because they don't know where that spec's going to be and what the possibilities are for redesign and how much redesign would be required or if redesign would be required. Again, depending on where the spec sets. But a lot of unknowns for CFL manufacturers to start redesigning now based on where it is, based on kind of where it can move. So everybody's going to have to almost wait till this finally settles out before they even contemplate their next move. But the next move they're going to redesign is going to take more than 9 months, I would think, to get those products back in the market. So it may be a little bit of redesign for LED, like you're saying, it meant to be minor. So for a lot of LEDs, it might be small, or they might be able to just recertify pretty quickly. I think our bigger concern as industries, the CFL market, it's going to be much greater impact. This is not a small change for CFL. This is a very large, significant change for CFL. We need that to be taken into account. And again, I don't know if you want to have different rules for CFL or LED, but it may get to a point where you might want to seriously consider that, depending on how this ends up.
Or Dave Gatto, Westinghouse Lighting. The other thing I want to add into that is, particularly as it relates to the CFL, even if it's just the spiral category, is the timing of this and the timing of Luminaires 2.0 and the potential for bulb in a box could be disruptive to residential lighting companies. The price point difference, so again, we're just speaking for Westinghouse, you know, we're looking at products that may be available two ways, with LED and dimming and with CFL to hit a particular retail price point that's appealing to the consumer. We're, you know, we're thinking about pendants and wall, decorative wall fixtures in particular, where they typically aren't on dimming systems, they're on-off. The price difference will be appealing to consumers, and they're already used to the products in those particular forms. So while I completely understand you don't want, you want technology neutral, but you don't want to have two different standards, is kind of the impression that I have. If we can find that sweet spot of you're raising the bar to pick up the efficacy where you can on CFL and leave room for some of these products that are going to not only fit the residential lamp category and energy saving opportunities, but also the very large residential lighting opportunity that we're just about to reach, which I know is important to EPA. It's definitely important to the lighting manufacturers as well.
Yeah, and Dave, thanks for bringing up that point. So you'll notice the harmonization with the efficacy levels, omnidirectional, good at that high. But the other two would make it a seamless, you know, transition for any Energy Star bulb to be used in that bulb-in-the-box option. Whereas with current efficacy levels, there could be room for confusion.
Yeah, no, I completely appreciate that. I think for me, it's really the Omni is where the biggest challenge is, and it's also where, from an energy saving standpoint in residential lighting, it's where the biggest opportunity lies because GU24 has not worked. But medium-based socket and a decorative light fixture that consumers are already interested in from a style standpoint, we think it'll be a big deal.
Great. Thanks for your comment.
Taylor, this is Noah, if I can jump in.
Yeah, please.
Hi, two quick points. One is on labeling. We didn't seem to cover that today, but there is some language on there about enclosed fixtures, and if it's not suitable for use in an enclosed fixture, that disclosure had to be made. But it currently, there is a lot of very fine print on the back of the panel where one finds that, and I'm wondering if there is a an openness to considering having requirements on the location and or fonts of those disclosures.
No, thanks for your comment. We didn't really try to touch labeling too much. The labeling that we're trying to achieve simply is the consistent labeling, so the consumer has information in a consistent fashion, and that was just for color temperature. We do, you know, the safety organizations actually cover those enclosed fixture, not for use in enclosed fixture ratings, but your comment is welcome, so thank you for suggesting that. I'm sure the manufacturers, as you've heard, are trying to avoid any packaging changes, as that is a tremendous expense, and they've just been through it with FTC relabeling, but it's something we can consider.
Okay, and sure, and the second thing is the meeting that you have planned for April 20th. As I understand it, it's a lamp conversation in the morning, and that would end at 12, and then in the afternoon at 1:30, the Luminaire conversation would occur. Earlier on, you said that you're removing the rapid cycle stress test for LEDs because that's probably not the best test for LEDs, but you would like to have something once it's available for LEDs. And I'm wondering if we could host if you could host a brown bag discussion of those optional, those people that are interested, to talk about where are we in the development of such a test and how do we move forward on that. And that's also, I think, an industry's interest because as that discussion evolves, that might make one more comfortable in speeding up the current testing and qualification time to 3,000 hours. If there was a corresponding stress test, that might make people more comfortable in a shorter time frame. So long-winded way of saying, are people open and interested in meeting lunchtime on the 20th if they're in town?
No, are you saying NRDC is hosting a lunch between our two meetings on
it? For lunch.
No, that's a nice suggestion. I My sense.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying at your meeting, I'm happy to bring cookies, but if
no,
there's
a. I get you. It's something we can consider. I think from our understanding of what's happening, there's still a significant amount of work that needs to be done. I feel like maybe that conversation we're a year out from. Maybe not quite a whole year, but I don't see us being able to make significant progress based on what we've been following in terms of industry research around this stress topic that could make it into the specification revision.
No. Let me be clear. I'm not saying it would be in time for this spec revision, but since many of the interested people might be in town, could we have an informal conversation to say, what are the research questions, what tests do people think would be useful, and how do we move those along?
Okay, that's a great suggestion. I'll take it under consideration.
And the first 12 people who sign up, I will buy them a cookie or a brownie.
Hi, this is Yuri from Sunshine Lighting. Oh, sorry about that. Hi, it's Yuri from Sunshine Lighting. I had a question about the power factor. Why is there little focus on it? Well, we're upgrading lumens per watts in efficiency, but we're going to keep power factor the same. I think that power factor plays a strong role in energy.
Yeah, it doesn't for lamps of this water.
What's that? Who was that?
Alex Bosenberg, NEMA, we have the USA study we can cite where power factor didn't make a difference. It's just these things are too small to make a dent.
Okay, fair enough.
We do, I mean, for LED lamps, our power factor minimum is 0.7. I think that's a pretty good point right now for balancing all the other factors. And you'll see there's quite a variety of power factors, and that's really up to the manufacturers. And there is some high power factor products, but they're all over the place. But it's not an area that we felt was significant enough impact to revise that requirement.
Letting the market kind of decide who's going to produce high power factor and who's going to produce more normal power factor. Is that what you're saying, Taylor?
Yeah, and for certain applications like commercial buildings, it's much more important. And so it allows, for the purposes of products, manufacturers that are developing products for that market to design higher power factor products for the commercial market where it does make has a bigger impact.
Taylor, point of clarification, Alex Baker, Phillips Wendelitz. Is that the April 20th meeting, has that been announced by email?
It has. So we announced it in our newsletter, but we had to revise the date, and we'll send out another notice.
It was in the newsletter,
and it was in the minder, but the newsletter actually has the 21st as a date, and I understand there's a conflict there, so we moved it to the 20th.
Thank you.
Yeah. We put that out for, it was in the reminder email for this webinar, but we'll put out another reminder. So people know, the luminaires, stakeholders know as well that there is a afternoon.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Taylor, Dave Guy, Westinghouse. I saw it in the newsletter for lamps. I don't remember seeing it for luminaires. That might have just been because I wasn't paying attention to that.
We hadn't set the times at that.
Exactly.
Might not have been relevant.
I just want to make sure that I'll share, in addition to Tom, who will get 17 copies, I'll make sure the ALA folks.
We'll get out an official announcement and allow everyone to register an RSVP as well shortly. We just wanted, it was more of a save the date at this point. We're still working on logistics, but.
Yeah. Okay. Hello, this is Mike Gershwitz. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. So I posed the question about 9.9 color angular uniformity. Could we maybe just, pose a quick question whether or not anybody is finding any useful input from that, difficult and expensive test in terms of, good information for consumers?
That's a great question. We don't have consumer surveys or anything to specifically address color angular uniformity. I do know that there were efforts underway by a collaborative group that specifically looked at beam patterns and color over beams of products in the market, and did find some concerns with it in terms of acceptability and preference. We don't hear a lot of complaints about that test procedure, but we felt it's valuable given the potential for those products to vary significantly over the beam in color.
Okay, so what I'm posing is kind of the reverse question. Our observations and a number of clients I've worked with have clearly shown a very loose, if any, correlation between a good color angular uniformity performance and a good performance in terms of color distribution, you know, from the luminaire or from the lamp. So what I'm really saying is this test, is it really providing any value to anybody other than the testing labs?
But I would say if you have data that's showing that test does not necessarily correlate to the consumer experience, we would love to see that.
Okay. I can check and see if that data can be made publicly available or not. Typically, the folks that have got, you know, poorly performing luminaires don't like to share that info.
True. Maybe it could be anonymized. I'm not sure if that's a word, but yeah.
Understood.
You know what I'm trying to get at. Remove their names and such. So.
Okay, I guess maybe the reverse. Is there anybody on the call who's familiar where that has been helpful? Or no opinion? Okay, I'll take it offline then.
Well, in terms of color angular uniformity, where that test would be helpful? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, typically we find is rate of color change is much more important than absolute magnitude of color change.
Okay.
And the CAU test doesn't tell anything about rate of change. That's where the problem is.
Okay, so you're talking about sharper changes are more noticeable than a smaller, sharper change over angle would be more noticeable.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We can show you some great yellow bands and things like that, which will pass color angular uniformity, no problem.
Okay. Again, if there's any way to get that to us, that would be helpful.
Okay. And I'm sorry, who am I speaking with on that side?
Oh, I apologize. This is Austin Gelbert, ICF International. I help out EPA. So.
Okay, Austin, I'll be happy to do that again. Mike Ershwood here, presently independent consultant. But.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, Mike, you can just send your information to lighting@energystar.gov.
And I'll see you.
Okay. Will do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more comments on the webinar? No?
Do we have any online comments?
Nothing on the webinar, from the webinar.
Okay, and just as a reminder, if somebody is trying to speak and has forgotten how to get themselves off mute, it is *6.
Is there a specific question? When version 1.0 came out, it was my understanding that the manufacturer could make the distinction between, let's say, directional and decorative. Sort of going to be their call.
What do you mean?
Well, when you go to your CB and you say, here, I've got a product.
It's determined by the lamp type. So in the very beginning of the spec, the scope.
Right.
It identifies the lamp types that fall under the directional, the lamp types, like shapes.
The shapes
that fall under.
Okay.
And it's specifically for the LED, since CFLs are not covered necessarily by an ANSI type, they are
well, if
by
you,
nature omnidirectional, right. If they weren't. they're not subject to those distribution requirements, so they're treated a little bit differently. But for LED, the lamp, specific lamp types are defined for the different categories and their intensity distribution.
Okay, I guess I was thinking of CFLs.
Yeah, so CFLs, because they're inherently omnidirectional for the most part, they're close enough. We don't even subject them to intensity distribution requirements.
Right.
Unless they're directional, fall under the directional product category, and then they...
Okay. But covered CFLs could they be omnidirectional or decorative?
It depends on their shape. Yeah.
It will depend on their shape.
Where they fall in the in the scope, yeah. But again, covered CFLs in general are not subjected to intensity distribution requirements.
Right.
Dave Gatter, Westinghouse Lighting. We'll, and I can talk to Austin offline. We may be able to provide some pricing information. I've been thinking about what you asked earlier. One of the things that I would suggest we recommend to EPA is that you consider doing a pricing survey, because while, you know, to Alex's point, some of that we won't be able to provide the way we would other information, because the NEMA can only do certain things, and pricing isn't one of them. So we, like I said, we have some information that we've gathered, and we can provide information probably up to NDA. I'll talk to Austin offline. But
yep.
At the same time, it may be worthwhile for EPA to take a look at that just to see if you've got, I'm thinking mainly like on some of these specialty LEDs, you have an item that has a high CRI or it has a particular shape, but if it's at a price point that isn't going to fit the consumer market, one of the things I would just remind you of is that there are products in here that we've certified under a residential program, knowing that the vast majority of demand is in the commercial market, where the pricing isn't as much of an issue. And I do want to kind of stay focused, particularly with lamps and with the luminaire changes we're making, on how do we fit that sweet spot for consumers, where it's going to give them the utility and the energy savings that we and they want, but also meet the pocketbook considerations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's important for us. And we did do some checking, but it is hard. So absolutely, any additional price information that you can provide would be helpful for our consideration. So
okay.
If there aren't any more comments or questions for today, we'll just end the meeting early, which is great. Give you guys all back some time. And just remind you to send us your written comments to lighting@energystar.gov by March 13th. It's helpful if you put Energy Star Lamp version 2.0 draft 1 comments in the subject line. But your comments are very important to us, so please do send them. Thank you all for attending today, and I really appreciate all the great comments and feedback we got today, and I look forward to seeing more of it.
Absolutely. All right.
Everyone have a great day.
Great.
Okay. Thank you. Good job.
Thank you.